This is PCJ Radio International.
From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. Myanmar has marked the 25th anniversary of the 1988 student protest, with a minister in the president's office meeting with former student leaders in Yangon. The Ottawa Daily News Service reports that Minister Aung Myin sat briefly on Wednesday with members of the movement, known as 88 Generation, before giving a short address. It is believed to be the first time authorities in Myanmar have acknowledged the anniversary of the country's pro-democracy uprising. On August 8, 1988, hundreds of thousands of people began demonstrating against the military government calling for reforms. The popular uprising ended September 18th with a military crackdown, killing at least 3,000 people and thousands of demonstrators jailed. Chris Lam was Australia's ambassador to Myanmar between 1986 and 1989, when the country was still known as Burma. He says the government's acknowledgement of the 88 Generation movement is symbolic of national reconciliation. President Thein Sein has decided to accompany reform and reconciliation, he said. He speaks next to Sen Lam.
My main recollection is that they began in September 87, really, and that was with the decision by the government, by General U Ne Win, to demonetize the currency and then plunge the country into a period of uncertainty about food prices and all sorts of other things that had to do with the average people. So that by the time they got to the middle of 1988 and the Burma Socialist Program Party had its congress, at that congress, for reasons that it takes too long to go into for this program's purposes, Ne Win resigned, and he was replaced by Sein Lwin, who was the man known as the Butcher of Rangoon.
The military was a very powerful force at the time. So was there either much courage shown by the protesters, or do you think their passion and belief overcame their fears of a possible violent military repression?
Many of them believed that the circumstances that had led Ne Win to resign would continue to roll on and that they would be successful, and so they believed they would be. They also believed that this was the way through the economic mess that the country was in and the problems with food prices and all the other things that there were. Sein Lwin was a man much despised. He was the man who'd led the military crackdown in 1962. He was the commander of the riot police, the national riot police, and he was a man with no respect in the country. But he was also a deep believer in astrology. Astrology dominates a lot of the thinking of many people in the country and still today.
Mm. And of course, the students' reading of the situation at the time was quite wrong, as we know now. The acknowledgement yesterday of the anniversary by a senior government minister, do you think that's part of the reform process, the current reform process, that a senior minister from the president's office actually met with the former leaders, student leaders?
It's about the way the president, President Thein Sein, has decided to accompany reform with reconciliation. So there's a reconciliation process running, which the government is very keen to pursue, and which is reflected by the composition of the parliament now and the place that Aung San Suu Kyi and others have in the country's governance. And so I wouldn't necessarily see it as part of reform in the standard sense that we use the word.
But it's a very tangible symbol of that reconciliation that you talk about.
Indeed it is. But other things are relevant too, such as the government's recognition that something needs to be done to commemorate what happened when the Rangoon Students' Union building, the University Students' Union building, was demolished by Ne Win. There's a lot of thought is being given to what should be done to take away those symbolic references that still contaminate the army now.
The 88 Generation and some of the former student leaders, they're currently holding a three-day event in Yangon to mark the anniversary. Looking back, do you think Burma lost some of its brightest and youngest at that time?
A lot of the youngest and brightest left the country, and that was a number of them were, I'm sure, killed and many more were imprisoned, but the larger number left the country and took up residence here in Australia and elsewhere in the world. And that was a big loss for the country, and that's what President Thein Sein has recognised, and he's trying to run programs that will encourage the diaspora to return.
And is that working?
Yes, I think so, but I'm not sure the bureaucracy and the bureaucratic capability to handle this has come out. But this means that if a person has left the country, from the ATA generation, for example, and come to Australia and become an Australian citizen and has surrendered Burmese Myanmar citizenship and then wants to go back, they go back on an Australian visa, but they're then subject to all sorts of visa controls. And until recently, I think probably still currently, if you want to go back and do any work, you need a business visa. There's a long process of application for that. In the first instances, at least, the business visa is valid for 70 days, so then you have to go out of the country, renew it, and come back again. It's very hard to work in those circumstances, so it is possible to get a business visa for longer than that, but you have to do several times the 70-day trial before you'll qualify for it.
So it's quite a complicated process, not a simple matter of just returning to Myanmar.
No, it's not a simple matter. If you wanted to go back as a tourist, that would be different, but it would prevent you from doing business in the way that you would want to. So there's a bill going to the Parliament now which will entitle people who, like the ATA generation, who've taken foreign citizenship to come back and then get permanent residence.
So things do seem to be moving in the right direction.
They are, but people are nervous, as you know.
Some former student leaders still see a kind of ambivalence on the government's part towards democratic reforms. How do you read the current mood in Naypyidaw?
I think the government's very determined to move ahead, but part of the problem is they don't really know what moving ahead entails. There's no experience with this. There's no experience in the country with multi-party democracy, and the last time that functioned in the country at all was in the 1950s.
And where does the military fit in all of this? How gingerly does the government have to tread with the military in the background?
I think most of the military would support quite actively what the government is doing. There would be commanders who probably don't, and who possibly have their own vested interests, maybe even corrupt interest in not seeing things move forward, but generally speaking, they do. Don't forget that in 1990, when they had the elections of the Assembly, where Aung San Suu Kyi did so well, her party won most of the main military bases.
The U.S. just 24 hours ago updated sanctions on Myanmar, maintaining a ban on importing precious stones like rubies and jade. And that's, of course, that gem trade is seen as largely tied to much suffering and abuse in Myanmar. What's your view of the gradual easing of sanctions?
Well, first of all, I hadn't seen that report. I'll have to go back and study it. But my first reaction to it is that a lot of the gem trade comes out of mines, ruby mines, for example, that have been handed by the government back to the tribes where they are, so that the Pa'o people in the Shan state control ruby mines.
Is that the case in most of its mining industry, gems industry?
No, I don't think it is, but it is the case in some, and so I'd like to know a little bit more about just how much of a blanket ban that is.
So what you're saying is that some of these mining activities actually benefit local communities?
Indeed, they do. And as part of the ceasefire deal that was struck by the then Prime Minister, Ken Yunt, with the Pa'o, for example, they get their ruby mine, and the profits from their ruby mine, I've been to these places, are then put back into local investment and building hotels and shops and whatever.
Well, you come and go regularly to Myanmar. What's your reading of the atmosphere in Myanmar? Do you think there's free and open political discourse? Are the people truly comfortable with the democratic reforms that the government ostensibly is proceeding with?
I think there's an incredible degree of freedom of expression. I took a group there from the Australian Institute of International Affairs, and the first meeting we had at the beginning of the tour, which we set up, was with the media group Democratic Voice of Burma, which was funded from Norway, based in Thailand, operating over the border in ways that led it to be condemned day after day by the previous regime.
We're very now familiar with the work of the DVB. Yes.
Sure, and so they've got their office now in Yangon. The bureau chief is an Australian Burmese, Utozo Lat. He does a terrific job, and yes, like anybody, he gets around the country, he gets his interviews, he gets things done. His freedom to operate seems to be unrestricted.
So you're
and
not...
I should say one other thing. They also have their television station. It's probably the most popular television station in the country. It's a news station.
Indeed. From your interaction with the Burmese diaspora, is that the current view that Burma has come a long way, that it's progressing down the right path?
Yes, but it's not there yet, would be the view. The diaspora probably have a firmer view about this than the locals.
Just very briefly, are you optimistic?
Yes. I guess one comment, if I may, Sen. It's very common when thinking about countries which have had long periods of military dictatorship or autocratic rule to see them emerge into some form of democratic process and recognize that it's going to take a very long time. Here we are. We had elections in 2010 that were widely condemned, but they returned a parliament which has turned out to be much more representative than people had expected, even though it's basically from one party plus the 40-odd NLD people. Now the question, as we come towards 2015 and the next elections, is not whether the elections will be held, which is the more common question in a lot of other countries, but who's going to win and what's going to happen after it. People are looking beyond the 2015 elections positively.
And also whether or not the military is happy to accept the results of it if they're not to its liking.
But then you come back to the constitution, which gives 25% of the seats in the parliament to the military. At some point, that will have to change. The military haven't indicated when they might be prepared to accept such a change, but I wouldn't think it'll come before the 2015 elections. So I think they will continue to have a hand near the brake.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there, Ambassador Chris Lamb. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Sen.
Vietnam has rejected criticism by the United States and the internet giants Google and Facebook that its new internet decree will breach human rights. Decree 72 comes into effect next month. Netizens say it will further curb freedom of speech and restrict sharing of information, while Vietnam says it aims to protect intellectual property and copyright. For more, here's Kenaha Sapati.
Vietnam has many laws to crack down on dissent or what it claims are anti-state propaganda. With the internet becoming the main avenue for dissent, Vietnamese authorities are now targeting the accessibility and exchange of independent information available on websites and blogs, says Lucy Morion, the head of advocacy and research for Reporters Without Borders.
It basically restricts the use of blogs and social networks to providing or exchanging personal information, and clearly bans the fact that internet users could use social networks, blogs, to share information from news sources. So this decree clearly aims at preventing Vietnamese users to have access to an independent information.
Decree 72 outlaws the posting of content on the internet which opposes the state and harms national security. But the law is vague and remains arbitrary in its definition of what is a state secret. Dr. John Ewer, the executive director of the Asia Internet Coalition, formed by eBay, Google, Facebook and Yahoo, says such ambiguity discourages foreign investment.
You need laws which are unambiguous. If, for example, you are to attract foreign investment, if you are to attract internet-based companies to set up shop in your country. And lack of ambiguity and lack of transparency, of course, plays into the hands of a bureaucracy that is more concerned with secrecy than it is with openness.
The law also demands that all foreign websites have at least one local server. This is not the first time that the government has been putting pressure on foreign internet companies to set up a local server. Google and Facebook, the two dominant players in the search and social sectors of Vietnam's internet market, have until now retained their offices offshore. And that's understandable, says Lucy Morion.
Because indeed it would subject the servers to Vietnamese law, and it would be much easier for the government or the court to get access to information and specifically personal data of internet users. When these servers are based abroad, the companies can better resist and confront Vietnamese requests with need for better argumentation so that they would give access to some of this information.
In an increasingly digital world where the economies are also going digital, laws like Decree 72 only destroys Vietnam's internet ecosystem, says Dr. Ewer.
If an economy like Vietnam wants to create a digital economy, it needs to have a regulatory regime which is pretty open and pretty flexible to encourage, you know, local entrepreneurs to come up with an idea, open up a website and promote a service. But with these regulations, there's no room for an entrepreneur. You'd need a lawyer to decide whether or not worthwhile setting up. So this is completely contradictory to everything we know about what helps to create a digital economy.
Vietnam has repeatedly come under fire for its harsh treatment and long jail terms for bloggers who dare to criticize the communist regime. Currently, 35 bloggers are in jail. But neither the harsh prison sentences nor the new law will totally deter other netizens from blogging, says Lucy Morion.
It would mean that the authorities would have to reinforce their surveillance of the internet, which is impossible. But we expect that they would use this decree to actually intimidate internet users, force them into self-censorship.
Dr. Yuen says the current situation between the Vietnamese authorities and its netizens is like a technological game of cat and mouse.
Technology is always developing in a way which allows people to avoid the obstacles, and then the state will put up new obstacles and so on and so forth. It's a kind of ongoing game. But I think as economies like Vietnam become more integrated into the world economy, they have to develop a kind of digital economy to go with that. And these kind of regulations just do not sit easily with those developments at all.
And that was Kanahar Sapati reporting. The chief executive of a company at the center of the latest dairy product scare in China has apologized. The CEO of New Zealand's Fonterra, Theo Springens, flew to Beijing to reassure the company's largest market. Mr. Springens expressed regret for the consumer anxiety caused to revelations that Fonterra milk protein had been contaminated by a bacteria caused by botulism. Consumer warnings have been extended in several countries about infant milk formula that might be affected. Karen Snowden has more.
Chinese parents have put their faith in imported milk formula because they don't trust local products. In a 2008 milk scandal, six infants died and hundreds of thousands were ill from baby milk formula tainted by melamine. Fonterra was indirectly implicated then because it held a stake in the Chinese company Sanlu, which added melamine to bulk up its formulas. The New Zealand company was criticised then for not blowing the whistle sooner, and now by no less than Prime Minister John Key. The problem product was made in March last year.
You'd think they'd take such a precautionary view to these things and say if it's testing for some reason in an odd way, that it would just be discarded until they were absolutely sure it's right. Now, that's something the chief executive will have to answer one day.
Chief Executive Theo Spearings flew from Europe to Beijing to hold a press conference where he said it was very important for him to personally offer reassurances. He added, "We regret the distress and anxiety which this issue could have caused. Parents have the right to know that infant nutrition and other products are safe," he said. It's the first appearance by a representative of the company, which has been communicating via statements posted on its website. It says there have been no reports of any illness linked to affected products, which include sports drinks and animal feed. Although the contamination is limited to particular batches of milk protein, some countries aren't taking any chances. Botulism is rare but very serious and can be fatal. Scott Gallagher is the Acting Director General of New Zealand's Ministry for Primary Industries.
We do face some market closures. Russia, for example, appears to have put a temporary ban on all New Zealand dairy products.
The suspect protein was also sold to Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, and sent to Fonterra's factory in Australia. Fonterra is New Zealand's biggest company, its biggest exporter, and the world's biggest exporter. Nathan Penny is an economist with Westpac New Zealand and says the share price was punished when the market first heard the news.
Started the day at $7.12 and went all the way down to $6.50, and then after that it did come back up to $6.80, so a fairly decent hit.
Fonterra has 10,500 farmer shareholders.
Oh, the main feeling is one of nervousness. How long will it last? We don't really know. We need more information to see how this plays out.
Fonterra's troubles might not be as easily contained as it hopes. According to the Xinhua News Agency in China, the Quarantine and Inspection Service has also issued a consumer warning for three batches of Caricare brand dairy products produced by another New Zealand company, Nutritia, which has initiated a recall in New Zealand. The affected products are not officially imported to China, but may have entered the country, according to the quarantine service, through undocumented channels.
Acid attacks on women are a disturbingly common part of life in South and Southeast Asia. Often the perpetrator is a spurned lover or a relative, and their weapon is a bottle of acid purchased for only a few dollars. In India, acid attack survivors have been fighting for increased regulation of the sale of the chemical. Last month, they had a triumph when the government introduced guidelines to restrict acid sales, but survivors say more reforms are needed. India correspondent Stephanie March has this special report.
Lakshmi was 15 years old when a 32-year-old man she barely knew asked her to marry him.
I said no, and one day when I was in market, the man's younger brother and his girlfriend attacked me. He put his hand on my face and she threw the acid on me.
The attack happened in broad daylight in an upmarket Delhi suburb.
The police took me to the hospital, then I fainted. The doctors threw 20 buckets of water on me. When my parents came there, I hugged my father, and even after the buckets of water were thrown on me, the acid ate through his shirt.
It also ate through the skin on her face, chest and arms.
I stopped my studies and it was 3 years before I came out of the house and started studies again and counselling. My life was unusual. I just went to the court and the hospital and I lost all my relationships and my friends.
Lakshmi's one of a disturbing number of women who are the victims of acid attacks across South Asia. Often emotional revenge born out of a refused marriage proposal, a lover's disagreement, or a family or property dispute, the consequences of acid attacks are devastating.
As a doctor, as a surgeon, we're used to dealing with death and accidents and injuries and so on and so forth. But when we see these girls and we see their mother and their family and we see and we know the future of this girl, it's really, really, really stressful.
Dr. Shahin Noraizdan is a plastic surgeon who treats acid attack survivors at an expensive private hospital in Delhi. While it's a crime that defies caste and social standing, Dr. Shahin says most of the women and girls struggle to afford the treatment they require.
They come to us with a lot of hope, and it all costs money. Many of them, they get aid from the local member of parliament or the government agencies and so on and so forth, some NGOs. And but it's tough. It's tough.
While the cost of treating victims figures in the tens of thousands of dollars, the acid itself is cheap and available in stores and households across India. It's commonly used for cleaning toilets and bathrooms.
I'm considering acid as a dangerous arm, a weapon.
Not long after Lakshmi was attacked, she and lawyer Aparna Bhatt filed a public interest litigation suit on behalf of acid attack survivors calling for change.
One, that there should be an amendment to the penal code which will include or specify acid violence as a separate offence so that the due attention is given to that. That's the first prayer we asked for. The second prayer we made is that sale of acid should be banned. The third one was about rehabilitation, and the fourth one was for compensation.
Last month, the government announced it would restrict the sale of acid and force retailers to keep detailed logs of the people who purchase it. Regulation or not, there's little doubt acid attacks will continue.
What I think will happen is it will only become that much more expensive and that much difficult to get acid. It doesn't mean acid production will completely stop. I'm sure it will happen, but it will only get more difficult.
Only days after the government announced the sale guidelines, a woman was killed and her two sisters injured in an acid attack in the central Indian state of Madhya Pradesh.
You can procure acid if you wanted to from a car battery. You can do anything. It's about abusing the woman. It's about maiming her. If you restrict them from the acid, they will do something else.
Lakshmi's fight is not yet over. She's now attempting to get the government to pay the medical costs of acid attack survivors.
Patients
So from 2007 to 2009, I have had 7 surgeries. I still have to go for surgeries on my ears, eyes and nose. And then there is cosmetic surgery.
She's already spent about $20,000 on surgery.
It's just ongoing, and it's never, it ends after a while when we decide that really we can't make her look any better. But mentally, they're completely finished. They cannot ever lead normal lives. No one will marry them. They know that. The families are completely distraught, and it's difficult.
While many agree restricting acid sales and paying medical bills will go some way towards helping victims, there's a deeper issue that India has to address.
My message for the boys is that it isn't the right thing that if the girl you want to marry says no, you throw acid on her. She's not always the right person for you, and that is the wrong thing to do. It is not that she was the right person. God may have made another person who is perfect for you. So the acid attack is not the way. When a boy goes out and he likes someone, it is not his right to go and throw acid on her.
And with that special report from Stephanie March, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, do send us an email at focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, by visiting our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. To find out more information about these and stories and other programs from PCJ, you can also find us on Facebook at any time. Just do a search for PCJ Media, PCJ Radio, click on Join the Group, and that's all you need to do. So on behalf of the whole team that helped put the program together, I'm Keith Pallon, wishing you all, hoping to see you again in 7 days' time. See you soon, and bye for now.